Welcome to the Veritas Forum, engaging university students and faculty in discussions about life's hardest questions and the relevance of Jesus Christ to all of life. For more information about the Veritas Forum, including additional recordings and a calendar of upcoming events, please visit our website at www.veritas.org. The following material is copyrighted and may not be duplicated, reproduced, or redistributed without prior written consent from the Veritas Forum. Join us as we explore true life.
In this lecture, I want to talk about the difficult and much discussed problem of evil, the problem of suffering in a world created and governed by God. I'm not going to attempt to solve that problem in this lecture. It's much too big a topic for one lecture. My aim in this lecture is rather to show one of the things regarding this problem which we can learn from the book of Job. But before I say anything at all about the problem of evil, I want to consider in some detail a preliminary question, a question about methodology. How should we approach philosophical and theological issues such as the problem of evil? What method should we use to think about them? I want to talk about this methodological issue because it's relevant to a general claim I'm going to make in this lecture, namely that believers need not think about this problem in the same way unbelievers do. Moreover, I'm going to claim in this lecture, if believers can't find a way to resolve the problem of evil, which is also persuasive to unbelievers, doesn't mean they have failed to find a solution to it. So I'm going to begin by looking at a basic methodological issue in philosophy, but I promise to show you very shortly what the payoff is, what the connection is between this methodology and the problem of evil. So if you hang in there and suffer for just a little bit on this methodological issue, you'll see it's good for something. It has become customary in philosophy these days to distinguish between what is called a third-person point of view and a first-person point of view. That difference is hard to define, but easy to illustrate. I have a first-person point of view about myself. And when I, from my first-person point of view, observe the only mind to which I have a privileged access, my own, here's what I'm aware of: beliefs, questions, doubts, desires, inclinations, willings, things like that. But if I were to go to a neurologist and the neurologist were to examine me, what he would find would be things from a third-person point of view, and that would be something very different. Here's what he'd find. He'd observe synapses, neurons, neurochemicals and their receptors, clumps of nuclei, bands of fiber, things of that sort. Guess what he wouldn't find? Beliefs and desires. None of the things he finds from his third-person point of view are observable to me. I'm not aware of my own neurons and synapses. When I introspect from a first-person point of view, that's not what I find. And what I do find from my first-person point of view, beliefs and desires and things like that, that's not what the neurologist finds from his third-person point of view. Now, this split between the first-person point of view and the third-person point of view has received a lot of attention in philosophy. Nobody really knows how to bridge that gap. But one of the things we might do to try to bridge it, one of the things I'm going to recommend in this lecture, is we might try bridging this gap by means of what we could call a second-person point of view. Now, to make use of this suggestion, we first have to understand it. What on earth would a second-person point of view be? What would a second-person account be? If I want to tell about a second-person experience, what would a second-person account be? And how would we distinguish that from those sensible first-person points of view and third-person points of view? Well, like this. A first-person account is a report I give of something from the point of view of my experience, a first-person experience. Okay, so analogously then, second-person account is some kind of report of some kind of experience suitably characterized as second person, from a second person point of view. Now, what's that? Well, I say that's the view we have when we have conscious awareness of some other person. The second person experience is going to include the kind of experience you have when you're conscious and you're in the conscious presence of another person with whom you're interacting directly and immediately. It's a kind of experience you have of your date if you're out for dinner on Valentine's Day. Such an experience is different from the experience I have when I'm by myself. In a first-person experience, I have direct and immediate conscious access to a person, all right, but that person's just me. Second-person experience is also different, however, from the sort of experience the neurologist has when he examines me. The neurologist's third-person experience puts him in contact with somebody other than himself, but it isn't necessary to the nature of the neurologist's third-person experience that the neurologist interact directly and immediately with that person considered as a person. The neurologist needs just the body, could be dead, could be even just a bodily part, just the brain. So a second person experience is different in character from a first person experience and a third person experience because it requires that you have at least one other person as a person directly and immediately present to you. And so that's the kind of experience we are having of each other right now. So that's what a second-person experience is, but what's an account? What's a second-person account? What's an account of a second-person experience? And why think it differs at all of an account given from a first-person point of view or a third-person point of view? If I give a first-person account, I give you an account of some experience of my own, some first-person experience. If the neurologist gives you a third-person account, he gives a report about some feature or condition he finds in me. So what's left for a second-person account to do? Well, here's what I want to tell you. If everything that you experience, everything you know in a second-person experience of other people, if everything you know in that kind of experience could be expressed in propositions about yourself or about the other person with whom you're interacting, well, then there wouldn't be anything left for a second-person account to do. First-person accounts and third-person accounts would be all you need. But in fact, there are things we know in our second-person experiences with one another which are either difficult or just impossible to put into propositional form at all. Okay, a skeptical objector may say, what could that possibly be? But see, if I give an answer to that skeptic's question, then I'll have an incoherent position. Because in answering the question, I'll be presenting in propositional form what I just said couldn't be presented that way. So is there another way of responding to the skeptical objector and showing that we learn something in our direct, immediate, conscious interaction with each other in second-person experiences? So a way of showing that we learn something in those experiences which we can't express propositionally. I think there is a way to show. One way to answer that skeptic is to do a thought experiment. Philosophers like thought experiments. You don't need lab equipment. They're cheap. So imagine somebody, call this somebody Mary. Imagine Mary, who from birth has been isolated by mad scientists and kept from contact with any other persons. So she has no second-person experiences at all. But suppose that she has access to all the information about the world as long as that information is only in the form of third-person accounts. So she has available to her the best science textbooks from any of the sciences, physics, biology, chemistry, sociology. She knows that there are other people in the world, and she knows everything science can teach her about them. But she has never had any interaction with another person. She's never seen a face other than her own. She's never had a conversation with anyone, and she's never participated in any way, even as a bystander, in anyone else's conversation. So she's never had a second-person experience. And now suppose that Mary's finally rescued from her imprisonment and united for the first time with her mother, who loves her deeply. When Mary is first united with her mother, it is indisputable that Mary will learn things she didn't know before, even if, before, she knew everything about her mother that science could make available to her, including her mother's psychological states. When Mary is finally united with her mother, Mary will learn what it's like to be loved by her mother, and this will be new for her, even if, in her isolated state, she had as complete a scientific description as possible of what a human being feels like when she senses that she's loved by someone else. Furthermore, it's clear that this is only the beginning. Mary will also know what it's like to be touched by her mother, to be surprised by her mother, to detect her mother's mood, to discover her mother's affect from the melody of her mother's voice, to match thought for thought in conversation with her mother, and so on. And these will all be things Mary learns, even if she previously had access to excellent books on human psychology and communication. So this thought experiment strongly suggests that there are things we know in our second-person encounters with another person which are difficult or impossible for us to describe from a third-person point of view or a first-person point of view. And that's because they're difficult or impossible to formulate in propositional terms at all. Now, I asked just a minute ago what a second-person account might be. But my description of this thought experiment might seem to have as its conclusion that a second-person account is just impossible. If what we learn in second-person experiences is difficult or impossible to express in propositional form, then how can we give any account of it at all? Now, in one sense, the implied answer to this question seems to me right. There is no way to give an adequate expository account of a second-person experience. But guess what? It doesn't follow that no account of it is possible at all. We can't express the distinctive knowledge we gain in such an experience in propositional form, but we can represent that experience in such a way that we can share it with others who weren't part of it. And this is what we do when we tell a story, whether that story is in narrative form or a poem or presented as a drama. A story takes a real or an imagined second-person experience and makes it available for a much wider audience to share. So the representing of a second-person experience in a story constitutes a second-person account. Now, whether stories, second-person accounts, are useful always in bridging the gap between first-person and third-person accounts depends on the nature of the particular gap. But these accounts do have a special place. Second-person accounts do have a special place in philosophy of religion, and here's why. The major monotheisms take God to be a person with a mind and a will, and it matters to many issues in philosophy of religion, but especially to the problem of evil, that God is taken to be a person who interacts with created persons. Insofar as those personal interactions make a difference to such issues as the problem of evil, stories about God and his relations to human beings, of the sort we find in the biblical narratives, those stories have a role to play in our philosophical and theological thinking about such issues. The classic biblical text having to do with the problem of evil is, of course, the book of Job. And with that much explanation of the role of stories in philosophy of religion, I want now to turn to Job. So guess what? We're done. That's it for the methodology. We're ready for Job. The book of Job is often treated as if it were little more than a philosophy treatise on the problem of evil. And the details and the intricacies of the narrative and its second-person context are neglected as uninteresting additions to the philosophically important debate about the problem of evil contained in the book. Furthermore, the debate is commonly considered to be unsatisfactory because it's taken to break off without a decisive conclusion regarding the problem of evil. The one thing Job wants, as he says over and over, is for God to explain to him why he suffers. And on the common interpretation of the book of Job, that's the one thing Job never gets from God. The famous Anchor Bible commentary on the book of Job is a good example of this sort of interpretation. And I can show what I want to say about the book of Job more easily by taking the Anchor Bible as my foil. Contrary to the common interpretation, I think that Job does get what he wants in this story. I think he does get an explanation of why he suffers. Consequently, I also think that the book of Job is helpful for thinking about solutions to the problem of evil. But we will see those things in it, on my view, only if we read it with careful attention to its character as a second-person account. The Anchor Bible, on the other hand, supposes that the story of Job gives us no help with the problem of evil. The Anchor Bible commentator says this. He says, "It has generally been assumed that the purpose of the book of Job is to give an answer to the issue with which it deals, the problem of divine justice or theodicy. This question is raised inevitably by any and every instance of seemingly unmerited or purposeless suffering, and especially the suffering of a righteous man. Job's case poses the problem in the most striking possible way. A man of exemplary rectitude and piety is suddenly overwhelmed with disasters and loathsome disease. How can such a situation be reconciled with divine justice and benevolent providence? It must be admitted first and last that the book of Job fails to give a clear and definitive answer to this question." So that's the Anchor Bible commentary. On the Anchor Bible reading of the book of Job, Job recognizes God's power, but he calls in question God's goodness in a series of vehement protests against God. Job's own passionate insistence on moral goodness in the governance of the world underlies Job's violent protests against God and his demands that God be called to account. Job's friends, the comforters, are shocked at what they take to be Job's blasphemy. They repeatedly point out to Job the contrast between Job's limitedness on the one hand and God's power and knowledge on the other. But Job rejects the comforter's attitude with scorn. Job readily grants that God has power. What's at issue for Job is God's goodness. So that's how the Anchor Bible reads it. And here, at any rate, I agree entirely with the Anchor Bible. As Job is portrayed in the dialogues with the comforters, Job is a person who refuses to submit to a God who is not good, no matter how powerful he is. Because Job makes such a strong indictment of God, the Anchor Bible maintains that God's answer to Job, which comes in God's speeches near the end of the book, the Anchor Bible maintains that God's answer is, the commentator says, a surprise and a disappointment. The issue as Job has posed it is completely ignored. No explanation is offered for Job's suffering. Job has already expressed his awe and wonder at God's power. He's questioned not divine omnipotence, but divine justice and mercy. The complete evasion of the issue as Job had posed it must be the poet's oblique way of admitting that there is no satisfactory answer available to human beings. And the Anchor Bible goes on to say, the fundamental question about suffering, if it's not for sin, then what is it for? Why is it? That question is completely ignored. It is understandable, the Anchor Bible commentator says, that readers are left with a feeling of chagrin at the seemingly magnificent irrelevance of the content of the divine speeches, What Job called into question with so much passion and rebellion was God's goodness, but the only attribute of God's on display in God's speeches to Job is God's power. So as the Anchor Bible reads the story, God simply fails to address Job's charge. And if that's right, then this part of the story certainly is both surprising and disappointing, as the Anchor Bible commentator says. But I myself think that there's something even more surprising and even more puzzling about the story of Job as the Anchor Bible interprets it. And it's something that the Anchor Bible commentator fails to comment on at all. What does Job do in face of the disappointing, high-handed description of God's power, which he gets in God's speeches, if the Anchor Bible's right? Well, on the view of the Anchor Bible, this is what the Anchor Bible commentator says. Job answers with humble acknowledgement of God's omnipotence and of his own ignorance. In the face of God's majestic declaration of his divine power, Job repents and recants. So on the Anchor Bible interpretation, Job not only takes back what he has been saying, but after the recitation of God's power, Job submits to God with a good deal of humility. But isn't that a surprising response to find on Job's part? It seems to me so surprising as to call in question the fundamental conclusions of the whole Anchor Bible interpretation. Is it really credible that after all Job's passionate focus on goodness, after all his defiance of the power of God, he simply collapses into a heap of humility when the almighty ruler of the universe comes to talk to him and Job has impressed on him how really powerful God is? Are we to suppose that Job was a pompous windbag, willing to complain about the boss of the universe behind his back, but utterly unable to stand up to him to his face? I don't see how anybody could read Job in this way. On this score, the Anchor Bible interpretation seems to me thoroughly implausible. Furthermore, the Anchor Bible interpretation can't account for the intensity with which Job repudiates his earlier accusations against God. After God's first speech, Job says, "Behold, I am vile." And after God's second speech, Job says, "I recant and repent in dust and ashes." If the divine speeches have as their only function reiterating the power of God, which Job has already acknowledged when he was alienated from God and insisting on an explanation of his suffering, then why do God's speeches have this effect on Job? Why do they produce so powerful a repentance of his earlier attitude towards God? He could, after all, submit to God with suitable deference without going nearly so far. The Anchor Bible interpretation thus gives us a serious incongruity in the character of Job. In the speeches to the comforters, Job is heedless of everything except goodness, and he's willing to confront even the power of God in demanding it. But in his response to God's speeches on the Anchor Bible interpretation, Job just cringes in front of power. Now, we can, of course, always chalk up an incongruity of this sort to the artistic incompetence of the author or editor of the narrative, though in this case it would be a fairly serious and dramatic incompetence. Even if the author or editor of the book wanted Job to be submissive to God at the end of the story, there are ways to write the story more plausibly than simply to have the rebel turn at once into a lackey in the face of God's assertion of his power. Furthermore, impugning the competence of an author or editor ought to be an interpretive strategy of last resort, to be employed when other attempts at explanation have failed. And in this case, it's also a particularly lame strategy because of the magnificent artistry which is readily recognizable in the rest of the book. Now, I'm inclined to think that the problem in the Anchor Bible interpretation arises because the Anchor Bible commentator is oblivious to the fact that the divine speeches are set in the context of second-person relations in the story they're part of, and themselves constitute a second-person account in their content. Consider, first of all, the content of the speeches. There's no question that the Anchor Bible commentator is right in thinking that these speeches of God's describe God's power. But the commentator seems to me to miss an equally important feature of the speeches, which is crucial for an adequate interpretation of Job's response to them. Look, for example, at the beginning of God's first speech, which the Anchor Bible characterizes as describing the power of God in the founding of the earth. That description is correct as far as it goes, but it's seriously incomplete. Here's what God says to Job. Where were you when I founded the earth? Tell me, if you know so much. Who drafted its dimensions? Surely you know. Who stretched the lines over it? On what are its sockets sunk? Who laid its cornerstone while the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy? Now, the Anchor Bible is right to think these lines represent God as having the immense power to create the earth. But they also show God's role in a community which participates in God's creating by watching what he does and rejoicing in it. Furthermore, this community is not passive. It responds to what it sees God doing, and the response is communal too. The morning stars sing, and the sons of God shout for joy. When God creates the earth, then he does not create alone. He shares his creating with a community of his creatures who rejoice together at that creating and sing. And clearly part of the point of the sharing is precisely to bring such joy to this community. And it's important not to miss the parental imagery here. The group that rejoices is the group of the sons of God. From the beginning of creation then and from the start of the divine speeches, God is portrayed not only as part of a community, but even as a parent. So what we see here in this first part of the first divine speech is not just the metaphysical attributes of power and knowledge necessary for God's creation of the earth. We also see God as a person in personal and parental relationships with his creatures, sharing what he's created with them and making them glad by doing so. The Anchor Bible characterizes the next part of the divine speech as a description of God's subjugation of the sea. Now, what God says in this part of the speech about the sea is this. He says, "Who shut the sea within doors when it came gushing from the womb? When I made the cloud its garment, dark mist its swaddling bands. When I put bounds upon it, set up bars and doors, saying, thus far come, but no more. Here your wild waves halt." It is important not to be oblivious to the second person account in these lines. In the first place, the imagery here depicts maternal relations between God and the sea. The sea is created by coming forth from a womb, and God deals with the sea as a mother deals with her child. He wraps it in swaddling band. He clothes it with a garment. The description of the creation of the sea is couched in the sort of language found in stories of a mother and her new baby. Furthermore, although the Anchor Bible characterizes these lines as a description of God subjugating the sea, it's noteworthy that God controls the sea by talking to it. In fact, it's hard to see these lines as a description of a subjugation. God doesn't simply bend the sea to his will. He doesn't just wield his great power to decree what the nature and attributes of a sea have to be. Almighty God could do that with an act of will alone. He doesn't need to make any utterances. Or if he wanted to determine what the sea could do by an utterance, he could make an impersonal statement addressed to no one in particular, like this: "I decree that the sea will extend from here to there, and it won't extend any further." But that's not what we get in the divine speech. Instead, what we get is a description of a personal interaction between God and the sea, God addresses the sea directly, and he addresses it as if the sea were a rambunctious and exuberant child of his, but nonetheless a child who can hear him, understand him, and respond to him. God brings the sea into conformity to his will by talking to the sea itself and explaining to the sea what it can and cannot do. The remainder of God's speech about the inanimate parts of God's creation continues in the same way. God portrays inanimate created things as if they were children of his, with whom he has a personal relationship and for whom he has a parental concern. Furthermore, he not only describes himself as talking to inanimate creatures, he also describes these inanimate creatures as responding by talking to him. God asks Job, "Did you ever command a morning? Can you send lightning scurrying to say to you, 'Here we are'?" So God talks to the morning. And when he sends the lightning where it should go, the lightning talks to him. The explicitly parental terminology continues here as well. God asks Job, "Does the rain have a father? Who has sired the dewdrops? From whose womb does the ice come? Who bore the hoarfrost of heaven?" These parts of the divine speeches constitute a second person account. They're not a story exactly, but they convey in the vivid sort of way a story would, a picture, an impression of God's entering into personal relationship with all parts of his creation and of dealing with his creatures in maternal sorts of ways. And this impression is only strengthened in the next part of the speeches, which constitute a second person account of God's dealing with animals, including those special beasts, behemoth and leviathan. For the sake of brevity, I'm going to consider just the description of leviathan in God's second speech to Job. Some of that second speech is devoted to describing the strength of behemoth and leviathan and the even more impressive power God has over them, including the power to capture them or even to kill them. But there are also passages such as this. God says to Job, "Will Leviathan make long pleas to you? Will he cajole you with tender words? Will he make a covenant with you? Will you take him as your servant? Will you play with him as with a bird or leash him for the maidservants?" For Job, the obvious answer to all these questions is no. For God, on the other hand, the answer is clearly different. God has a close relationship with these great beasts who not only talk to him with tender words, but cajole him, plead with him, play with him, and make covenants with him. It is a mistake, then, to characterize God's speeches as demonstrating nothing but God's power over creation. The speeches certainly do show God's power, but equally importantly, they show God's personal interaction with all his creatures. God relates to everything he has made on a face-to-face basis, as it were. And in these personal interactions, God deals maternally with his creatures, from the sea and rain to the raven and the donkey, and even the monstrous behemoth and leviathan. He brings them out of the womb, swaddles them, feeds them, guides them, and plays with them. Most importantly, he talks to them, and somehow, in some sense or other, they talk to him in return. These speeches thus show God as personally and intimately involved with his creation. And they portray him as having a parental care toward all his creatures, even the inanimate ones. The divine speeches don't make claims about God's relations to creation. If they did, they would be a third-person account, laying out some general theological position. Instead, the divine speeches constitute a second-person account, which lets us participate, to some limited extent, in the perception of God's relation to inanimate things, plants, and animals. The divine speeches began with a reference to the morning stars singing together and the sons of God rejoicing as they watched God's dealings with his creation. To some minimal degree, the speeches invite us to see what they saw. The implication is that if we see it, we also will be inclined to rejoice. What Job wanted was an explanation of God's relations with him, and he does get it. But he gets it in the form of a second-person account. He had demanded goodness. What he gets is a pale copy of what caused the sons of God not just to find God good, but to rejoice in him and to rejoice in God's relations to his creatures. What exactly is that, you might think? But for the reasons I gave you in the methodological section, I don't think that question can be answered, or at least not answered without remainder. The question is a request that what is presented as a second-person account be translated into a third-person account, and I argued that that couldn't be done without losing what's most important about a second-person account. Nonetheless, I do want to say one thing which is, in my view, suggested by the second-person account of the relations between creator and creatures in the divine speeches. The divine speeches suggest that God's relationship to all his creatures is personal, intimate, and parental, maternal. Now, a good mother will sometimes allow the children she loves to suffer, but only in case the suffering benefits the child who experiences the suffering and benefits that child in some way which couldn't have been equally well achieved without the suffering. A good mother, for example, would not cause suffering to an innocent child of hers for the sole purpose of getting her boss to learn a lesson. In the same way, God is portrayed as giving the animals what they need just because they need it, food for the baby birds who cry to him, help in mothering for the foolish ostrich. There is never any suggestion that God considers whether the hunger of the baby birds might not be a good thing for the cats in their neighborhood. God doesn't think about whether the need and weakness of the baby birds might not be turned to good account for some other part of his creation, so that letting them stay hungry is justified by the good it produces elsewhere in the world. Rather, in the divine speeches, God just considers what will be good for the baby birds, and so he feeds them when they cry. And so there is a suggestion, a picture, a portrayal that leads us to think God operates on that principle I attributed to good mothers. Nothing in God's speeches to Job specifically describes God's relation with human beings, of course, but there is certainly a ready inference, both for Job and for us as the audience of the book, a ready inference from the way God deals with the rest of his creation to the way in which God deals with human persons. If God deals maternally with even the inanimate parts of his creation, if he seeks to preserve the good even for infant ravens, then a fortiori in his dealings with human beings, God will operate in the same way, allowing their suffering only in case he can turn it to their good. If an innocent person suffers, then it will only be because a good God, a loving God involved face to face with his creatures, produces out of that suffering a good for that person, which couldn't have been produced or produced as well without the suffering. The inference to this explanation about suffering is available to Job, as I said, but if I'm right about second-person accounts, Job doesn't need to draw it, because in the second-person accounts and the divine speeches, Job has something more epistemically powerful than knowledge gained through inference. In addition, however, Job has another source of information about God's reasons for allowing him to suffer, and it's even more powerful than the second-person account in the divine speeches. It's the second-person experience of God, which Job has while God is talking to him. The Anchor Bible, which doesn't see or doesn't accord much weight to the personal interactions described in God's speeches, also doesn't recognize the importance of the context in which the divine speeches are set. While God has been talking to Job, what's the relation between Job and God supposed to be? We don't have to speculate because Job explains it in his last lines to God. Job says to God, "I had heard of you by the hearing of the ear, but now my own eye has seen you." While God has been talking, Job has been seeing God. The communication between God and Job is thus face-to-face communication. In the course of the divine speeches, God has been somehow directly present to Job. The second-person account of the divine speeches to Job is thus set in the context of a second-person experience of God for Job. When Job complained bitterly about the goodness of God, his charge wasn't just a metaphysical complaint raised for philosophical reason. It was a personal complaint. Job's history before the start of his suffering is a history of trust in God and obedience to God, as Job makes plain in his speeches to the comforters. Job's protest against God in the dialogues thus at least implicitly includes a charge of betrayal of trust. But for a charge of betrayal of trust, a face-to-face encounter can make all the difference. To answer a mistaken charge of betrayal of trust, a person who loves you can try to explain, or he can just face you and let you see him. If Job can see the face of God who loves his creatures as a mother loves her children, then he will see or feel in some other way that he is encompassed by that love too. So in the sight of God which Job has, in the second-person experience of God, in the course of the divine speeches to him, Job has another vivid and effective response on God's part to Job's demand for an explanation. The sight of the face of a God whose mothering love is directed even towards rain and ravens is also an explanation of Job's suffering. I began by asking how we could explain Job subsiding into humility and acquiescence after all his defiance of God and his insistence on justice, if God's speeches to Job contain nothing but an assertion of God's power. What a closer look at the speeches makes clear is that this question rests on a false view of the content of the divine speeches and an obliviousness to their context. If we see the divine speeches in the way I have just been explaining, a second-person account set in the context of a second-person experience, showing Job the love of God, then we can understand better why Job reacts to the speeches as he does. Suppose you had been sure that the person who should love you the best had betrayed you, had abused your trust, and used your vulnerability to him to cause you pain. Suppose that you had given vent to your anger and sense of betrayal in vehement speeches to his friends or to anybody who would listen. And suppose you had made those views known to him too. And then suppose two things happened. First, you were vividly and forcefully reminded of the deeply loving character of your supposed betrayer and all the good he's done in the past. And secondly, you saw that powerful goodness and love directed towards you in his face. How would you feel? You might very well feel stricken, abashed, ashamed, repentant. Just the sort of emotions we find in Job. Job says, "Now my own eye has seen you." And he follows that line with this one. "So I recant and repent in dust and ashes." Job wanted bare justice, but his face-to-face experience with God goes past justice to love. So Job does have an explanation of his suffering, but it isn't the kind of explanation that philosophers have been interested in when they consider theodicies, because it isn't a third-person account. A second-person experience can constitute a good explanation of a mistaken charge of betrayal for the person who has that experience. But it would be hard for him to use that experience to convince a third party for just the reasons I gave when I was explaining why second-person accounts differ from third-person accounts. How Job knows what he knows, that his suffering is at the hands of a good and loving God, that's hard to explain to someone who wasn't part of the same second-person experience. The best that can be done in such cases, as I explained above, is to turn the second-person experience into a second-person account of the sort we have in the story of God's conversation with Job. But stories aren't arguments. They can't compel a certain view of things, as arguments are meant to do. Furthermore, they are much more likely to be persuasive to people who've had some experience of their own of the sort being described in the story. That's why people reveal themselves when they explain what novels they find moving. Furthermore, what Job knows, that God loves him and didn't betray his trust, that may not be the kind of explanation that someone looking for a third-person account wants. Consider a sick child brought to the hospital for painful procedures by his mother, but who also has a shared history of loving relations with his mother. It may be enough for the child to know that his mother allows him to suffer only because she loves him. But an outsider who doesn't know the mother, who has no relation to her, may well want to know exactly what the connection between the suffering and the child's well-being is before he's willing to grant that the mother's justified in allowing the child to suffer. So here's what I want to say at the end. I'm almost done, just finishing. For these reasons, the problem of evil has to present itself differently to believers and unbelievers. Believers come to the problem of evil with what they take to be a history of relations with the God they believe in. They can and they should draw on that history in reflections on suffering in their own lives or in the lives of others. In such a history, there is a second-person experience that ought to make a difference to the way in which believers approach the problem of evil. Furthermore, the second-person accounts of God, the stories about God in Scripture, will be read differently by believers who have their own religious experiences to draw on as they read them. They'll be read differently from the way in which they're read by unbelievers. Just as the second-person account in the divine speeches will strike Job differently from the way in which they strike an outsider. So what a non-believer requires as a satisfactory solution to the problem of evil may be unnecessary from the point of view of a believer, because believers draw on second-person accounts in a way that non-believers do not. On the other hand, what is a successful resolution of the problem for a believer may very well not be persuasive to a non-believer, because believers and non-believers bring different epistemic states to consideration of the problem of evil, different sorts of evidence or argument will be needed to resolve it. And that is, in my view, one of the lessons of the book of Job, which we learn when we're sensitive to the nested second-person accounts that make up much of the book. And that helps to explain why contemporary academic accounts of the book take the form that we find in the Anchor Bible Commentary. The Anchor Bible Commentary sees that book as raising a charge of injustice against God that is never answered. But if you look at the commentaries on the book of Job written by committed believers in the Middle Ages, for example, if you look at the way a committed believer such as Thomas Aquinas reads that same text, he sees the book of Job as giving us a good explanation of the way in which a loving providence operates to govern the world. And that's it. I'm done. Thank you.
Okay, we're going to have a brief time of questions and answers. As we're doing that, I think the ushers were going to pass around a clipboard. We'd like to get your response to the program this evening, but we'd like to do it by email. So if you'd be so kind as to just put your email address, we'll email you a little short survey that you can then fill in, and it helps us as we're planning programs for the next year to get a better sense of what you particularly enjoyed about the different Veritas sessions and what you might think would be helpful as we plan this program for next year. For those of you who'd be willing to come down and ask your questions, we like to use the microphones. They look like they're very tall. Somebody may want to sort of lower them. It looks like they're for 7 or 8 feet tall people. Or you can lean them over as you like. That way we'll all be able to hear the question, and particularly Dr. Stump, who needs to hear it most importantly of all. So would somebody like to be first and come down and join in this conversation? Come ahead.
I think it's okay. Okay, so you were criticizing that third-person perspective on the Book of Job, but I was wondering what you think about the interpretation of Emmanuel Levinas on the Book of Job, where he would also think that it's against theodicy, yet his is obviously, I think, what you would call a second-person interpretation also. So I was just wondering what you thought about that.
I don't know Levinas' interpretation of the Book of Job, but in general, I think Levinas' Talmudic commentaries, which are often commentaries on biblical texts, I think Levinas' Talmudic commentaries are absolutely terrific. I think they're terrific. But Levinas' whole philosophy is characterized by an insistence on just the sort of thing I was calling attention to, because Levinas thinks that what is crucial for doing philosophy, what is crucial for doing ethics, what is crucial for philosophy of religion, is somehow having in always before you that what he calls the face of the other. Now, I'm not a Levinas scholar, and I don't really have a foggy clue what Levinas meant by saying you have to keep in front of you the face of the other. I mean, to me, it seems if there are many others and many faces, but never mind, I take Levinas as an ally. He thinks there is something you learn in face-to-face contact with another human being which you just can't get in any other way, and that philosophy ignores it at its peril. And there I think Levinas is entirely right. So I'm inclined to think that if Levinas were still living, and I'm so sorry he's not, and we had a chance to talk with him, I think Levinas would see the Book of Job my way. That's what I think.
Okay. Ooh. I want to say it's very interesting that you had to look to Thomas Aquinas, who lived in the 13th century. When did he live?
I'm sorry, I'm having some
when
trouble
did
hearing
you. When did? Oh, okay. So I want to say it is very interesting that you had to look to Thomas Aquinas to find one of the second person's experiences, the second person commentaries to the Book of Job. And I think that modern Christianity or Western Christianity puts a lot of accent on rationalism. They want to explain everything. They want to put everything in words, and I think that is a huge mistake. And whereas the Eastern Christianity did not do that, and if you look at the when they write, they put accent on the second person way of approaching God. And I was wondering, is there a just comment upon that. I was wondering, is there a good way to explain to people whatever that second person ways of dealing with questions about God are better than third person ways of dealing with questions about God?
Well, I'm not entirely sure I understood the question, so you may need to ask it one more time. But
okay.
Here's what I would say. I didn't actually have to look at Thomas Aquinas. I just wanted to because I like him. He's somebody I work on, somebody I think is a very good help for us in thinking about major issues. But I also think it's quite right that in Western philosophy, especially in Western English-speaking philosophy, especially in English... in Western English-speaking philosophy in the 20th century, there has been a kind of obliviousness, a kind of total obliviousness to the importance of personal relations in thinking about major theological issues. Now, why that should be, I wouldn't presume to say. I wouldn't presume to say it because I'm female and it's a very male-dominated field and gender issues are enough to get you killed these days, and I don't feel interested in being martyred on gender issues. But it might be that that would be the direction to look for an explanation. Just maybe, I don't say. But that may not have been what you were asking. You may want to ask your question one more time. Or here's another way of responding to you. Suppose it's right that Western philosophy hasn't done that. Okay, so who cares? Western philosophy is up for grabs. You can see it was missing something, so let's add what it was missing. Let's think about personal relations, face-to-face encounters, and stories. Let's add it in.
Good.
I'm not sure if you're that familiar with Rabbi Harold Kushner. He had made a distinction in his work between pain and suffering, that suffering is an emotional response to pain. And if we're equating the problem of evil here with just the problem of suffering, wouldn't God's extension of the offer of a personal relationship be as much a solution to the problem as evil as just a statement about it?
Well, you want to think about, when you think about the problem of evil, you want to think about why it is that an omniscient, omnipotent, perfectly good God would allow the suffering. Why he would allow it. And for that, we want to think about a whole array of issues, only some of which I touched on in my talk on Job. But personal relations with God are right at the heart of it. See, sometimes when we think about what could justify anybody in allowing suffering, we think about things that have nothing to do with relationship. So we think about whether it's good for your character if you suffer, and think about whether you might grow in virtue if you suffer, and so on. But another thing to think about is what the effect of suffering is on personal relationships, especially a person's relationship with God. And there, if you look at the Bible, what you find is that those people who are especially close to God are always people who have suffered a great deal. So that the Bible sums it up by saying, whom God loves, he chastens. So that would be what I would say about that.
Thank you.
Is it possible that we look at pain and suffering from a point of view of a mortal, and that it's difficult for us to look at pain and suffering without thinking of death? For example, one might ask, you know, why the Holocaust? Why 9/11? And you think of pain and suffering in those terms, where death to a mortal represents an ending, and possibly death to God represents a beginning. Is there any philosophical basis for, or rational philosophical basis for thinking in that manner, that maybe the reason we don't understand suffering is we view it from a point of it ending, always ending in death?
Well, I think that's a good question. When someone dies and we grieve, we want to think a little bit about what it is that we are grieving for. But I do not think that doctrines of the afterlife take that grief away from us. You can see it very nicely, very clearly, in the story of Mary Magdalene at the tomb. Mary Magdalene is at the tomb looking for the body of Christ and weeping because she cannot find it. And the angels say to her, he's risen. He isn't here, he's risen. And she doesn't stop crying for a moment, because she was never crying because she thought he was in trouble. She was crying because he was gone. And that absence of a loved person, that is a great grief. And the thought that this person is now in heaven with God does not take that grief away. So I would say, even around the subject of death, there is a great deal of heart-cracking suffering that needs some sort of philosophical consideration.
Dr. Stump, thank you for coming in your wonderful interpretation of the book of Job. But if we could tie in what you said to the prose frame story with which the book begins, and especially Satan's challenge about Job to God. Satan says that if you take away all of the gifts that you have given him, he'll curse you to your face. But when God actually, as you said, appears to him face to face, it's exactly the opposite is what happens. So, and what enrages Job, really, are these third-person accounts that the comforters are giving. So do you think that that sort of ties in, that that when you give to someone a third-person account when they're actually suffering, as you were talking about Mary Magdalene, that that just makes matters worse, and that you need to try to do what God did to Job, you know, try to, you know, bring them back into relationship as much as you can?
Well, there are at least two questions in these remarks, and I'm going to take the second of them first. The second is a question about what we do when someone is suffering. And there I would say it's one thing to try to understand what would justify God in allowing suffering. It's another thing entirely to think about how to bring any kind of comfort and company and consolation to someone in their suffering. A person who is in anguish is not a person in a good condition for doing philosophy. And that is not the right time to bring him philosophical considerations. The right thing to do is sit next to him in silence and see what kind of consolation just bare company can bring. But there is something obscene, or at least cloddish, about trying to do philosophical theology with a person reeling from the shock of great sorrow and great pain. So it seems to me quite right. That is not a point for any kind of third-person accounts. Now, the second question I saw in these remarks has to do with what is sometimes called the framing story of Satan. It's customary in sophisticated circles to be embarrassed about the framing story of Satan and to try to just snip it out, a kind of primitive bit tucked on to a very sophisticated reflection on the problem of evil. But actually, I myself think that's a mistaken way to approach the story of Job. If you take all the parts of Job together and read them as one whole, what you find is a very complicated structure of nested second-person accounts. So there are the second-person accounts of God's relation to the rain and the birds, set within the second-person account of God's speech to Job, set within the dialogue about Job's suffering at the hands of God, which is itself set within the broader context of God's dealing with Satan. The thing that is interesting about these nested second-person accounts is that they show providence as operating in the manner of a fractal. You know what a fractal is? It's a funny mathematical formula such that when you graph it, the individual bits of the graph look exactly like the pattern of the whole. And if you take the parts of the parts, they look just like the whole of which they are the parts, and so on down to the ground. The book of Job works that way. So God's relation with the ravens and the rain operates on the mothering principle I sketched, and so does his relation to Job, and so does his relation to Satan in the framing story. That's what I would say. So if you read the whole thing as one whole altogether, you become sensitive to the very sophisticated, very complicated structure of nested second-person accounts, and that does show you another thing about the nature of providence. So that seems right.
We understand from the Bible that Jesus Christ was fully God and fully man, and he has gone, means he suffered. Is there anything we can learn from his life, how he handled the suffering?
I have a feeling I don't understand this question because it's a yes or no question and the only right answer is yup. And so I think I must have missed something in this question.
Uh, Jesus Christ was fully God and fully man. And he suffered. And he experienced great suffering. And he handled the suffering on the cross. Is there anything we can learn from his life, how to handle suffering in a gracious way and also see God's purposes in refining our life?
I myself think the best way to learn from him is to learn from the double movement in the Garden of Gethsemane. So if we look at him in the Garden of Gethsemane, he does not say to God, "Hey, whatever. You're God. You do what you want. That is good with me. Whatever." That's not what he says. He says to God, "Here's what I want. I know what it is, and I'm going to tell you what it is. I don't want this suffering. But I'd rather do things your way than my way if we disagree." Now that's two movements of spirit. I think so often we try to skip the first movement. We try to say to God, just look, I don't care, whatever. And that is inhuman. It's inhuman and it distorts something about humanity in us. No heart can really say that all the way down to the ground without distortion, without some radical inhumanity. It is important to say to God, here's what I want. I want not to die. I want not to suffer. I want my daily bread. But if your will and my will are not the same, then I'd rather do it your way than my way. That's the second movement. And that's not because, see, here's the other thing I think is very important to see about that second movement. That's not because after having told them what you want, you then go on to say, but hey, you know, I don't care, whatever. That's not it. It's because he is the wildest, most beautiful, most loving, most good thing there is. And is all things considered much better to accept affliction at his hand than not to be at his hand. Because whatever it is he's doing is definitely something that you would want if you only understood exactly what he had in mind. So it's not the second movement there of Christ in the Garden of Gethsemane is not a matter of saying, look, I have no heart's desires. I don't care about anything. Just do whatever you want with me. That's not it. It's saying, in the end, what I want most of all is you. And there's a reason for that, because you are most worth having. So if we need to do it this way to get to you, that's the way I want to do it. So that's what I think we learned from him.
I'm kind of trying to formulate this question. So one, are you very familiar with John Piper and any of his writings, Desiring God? Well, that may never. Then I'll just add back up some and say, do you think that God, even apart from the person of Jesus Christ, do you think that God the Father has an aspect of suffering and pain? And more than I guess yes or no, how and what do you think that's like?
There's a Scylla and a Charybdis here. If you say God doesn't suffer, that's a heresy. If you say God the Father suffers, that's a heresy. The patristic period found a clever way to sail between these two heresies. And here's what it was. They said, God the Father does not suffer, but God suffers because the person of the incarnate Christ is a divine person, the second person of the Trinity. And I guess what I'm inclined to think is we belong to a community that stretches throughout all the ages. And you're never really likely to get it right if you set off by yourself to start from scratch. So in medicine, we understand that we are part of a community. And a guy who says to you, the whole medical community is wrong, but I myself, I and I alone, know how to cure cancer, chances are pretty good he's wrong, you know. I mean, every once in a while he might be right. I mean, it's not impossible, but chances are pretty good he's wrong. For everything complicated in human life, we do better if we stick with communal wisdom, because none of us by himself is good enough all by himself to get things entirely straight starting from scratch. Not in medicine, not in biology, not in physics, not in literature, not in theology either. And so to me it seems wise when the tradition from the patristic period onward has hammered something out, it seems to me wise to pause and reflect about whether they might not have it right. They do get stuff wrong, you know, like any community does get stuff wrong. But on the whole, it's better to be kind of slow and careful before you jettison what the community as a whole has come up with. And the community as a whole thinks those two things are heresies. Seems to me they found a good way to sail between them. I accept the solution. That's what I'd say.
First, I'd like to thank you for really a magnificent presentation. And what I'm wondering is there a place to have this recorded? Is there a reference I you know, could find to follow up on this? And, you know, just, you know, I've responded to all, but I don't know if I've fully integrated it, and I'd like to return. Is there a reference that I might go to?
If you send me email, okay. And Dr. Bradley can give you my
sure.
email,
okay.
I would be happy to send you, not for attribution, not for citation typescript, but this is a work in progress, will be published by Oxford University Press if I live long enough to finish it. But it's not done. It's part of a big project that encompasses lots of biblical narratives, and it's not done. So it's not published, and it won't be until I say it's finished.
Okay, I'll certainly do that. Thank you.
First, I want to thank you for a very interesting presentation. I wanted to ask whether I got right that you appealed mostly to Thomas Aquinas.
No, I didn't appeal to him at all, actually. I just referred to him at the end in one sentence.
Okay, and that's one thing. The other thing is that the issues you presented for the sufferings of Job are some theologian would think that it's secondary to the main issue, which is actually salvation, and they can see the person of Christ and his symbols in all the work. Where do you put salvation in the book of Job, and whether you think that was really the main issue or not?
Well, not every theological issue is reducible to the problem of evil. There are many theological issues to think about. Theology is a big, complicated thing. And I am looking at only one, in this lecture, looking at only one theological issue, the problem of suffering. For the problem of suffering, the classic biblical text is the book of Job, because that's what the whole book is focused on. And although there are certainly wonderful passages in Job about the Redeemer, about salvation, they are just glimpses here and there. By and large, the book as a whole is about the way in which God, in his providence, allows people to suffer when the suffering is not punishment for sin. That's what that book is about. Now, there certainly are lots of biblical texts focused on other things, and some of those other things are salvation. Those are important and good things to think about. But they were not on the agenda for this lecture this day.
My question has to do with suffering. And I'm assuming you would agree that much suffering, if not most, of our personal suffering has to do with our own wrong choices, and if not really God-ordained suffering. It's when God told Adam and Eve in the garden not to eat of the fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil, they had a choice. And this would be a completely different world if they had obeyed.
Well, I guess we want to distinguish two questions here. One is, how did suffering come into the world in the first place? And the second question is, how is suffering distributed now? And it is part of the Christian story that suffering entered the world with Adam and Eve. And that seems to me entirely right. Some wit, I can never remember who it was, Oscar Wilde or Mark Twain, I can never remember who it was, but some wit said, the doctrine of original sin is the only theological doctrine overwhelmingly confirmed by empirical evidence. So I certainly accept that explanation. I think it's very hard to make sense out of Christianity or Judaism either without it. But the other question is, how is suffering distributed in the world now? And there I would say, certainly not in accordance with our choices. So if you look at, pick up your newspaper and look at any account of suffering that's on the front pages, and it will not be that the people who suffered, suffered because they chose in a certain way. Think about the tsunami victims. Think about the people who are civilians caught in warfare. Think about the newspaper discussion of AIDS in babies in Africa. These are not people who chose and in consequence suffered. These are people who are the victims of suffering. And there we want to think about why God would allow the world to be run that way.
Now that you mentioned the tsunami, for example, or this suffering events or causes of suffering not related to will, human will, and my question is, did you mean in your talk about the Book of Job that somehow God tells us or told Job to that he sends that suffering, sends, inflict that suffering, those he sends us those events, or Job those events to his family and stuff, for something or not? Or he just is saying that it doesn't matter if you suffer, I'm with you, or something like that?
I'm not sure I understand all the question, but part of it seems to me to come to this. How are we to think about the suffering in the Book of Job that isn't Job's suffering? Job's children die, his servants die, the animals are taken away. How are we to think about all these different kinds of suffering? And what I want to say is that one of the lessons that the Book of Job teaches us is that to understand suffering, you have to look at each individual sufferer's story. What is their life story? What is their psychology? What is their relationship to God? What's the role of the suffering in their life? You can't understand the role of suffering in a life if you don't understand that life. Now, in the Book of Job, the focus is on Job. That's the only focus. But I myself think if we extrapolate the lesson from the Book of Job, then we have to extrapolate it like this. Whatever reason there was for God to allow the death of a child, it has to be because somehow, something in the way that death at that time works into the life story of that human being draws that human being nearer to God then, something like that. That is, what we are not going to say out of the Book of Job is that those children died just because it was useful for some good in Job's life. That's not what we're going to say. So that's how I would answer the question.
Thanks.
Let's have maybe one more, if there is one more, and then maybe that will be the last one.
I'll get up one more time. My name's John Green. I'm a professor over here at the Department of Health and Kinesiology. And you spoke a while ago about wit. One of my favorite movies of all time is a movie called Oh God. Are you familiar with the movie with George Burns and John Denver?
You know, I have to tell you, I'm not. I'm so sorry.
If you ever have a free couple of hours, you might want to watch the movie. It's funny and at the same time gives some insight. And when God, in the person of George Burns, first appears to John Denver, he does so in person for the first time in the bathroom as John Denver is coming out of the shower. And after he gets through quaking, his first question is, how can you permit all the suffering that goes on in the world? And God's response in the person of George Burns is, how can I permit it? How can you permit it? Is there anything in the book of Job that we can take this view? Is that if, you know, for example, Christ prayed that God's will be done in the Lord's Prayer, intimating that on this earth, God's will is not done and sin is done. And that if we focused our energies and were less sinful and focused our energies on things that were more important, that we could indeed reduce the amount of suffering. Is there any way we can relate that to the book of Job?
Well, I myself would not like to take my theology from Hollywood. I mean, we could start with that. But you can't quarrel with this theological lesson. If we sinned less, the world would be better off. I mean, that is really hard to quarrel with. That seems certainly true. It seems so true that it doesn't need an authority behind it. I mean, it's just plain on the face of it, isn't it? If you were nicer to your mother, right there, the world would be better. I mean, we can start with that. So I think that that's entirely right. But see, here's the question. When you aren't what you ought to be, somebody else sometimes feels the brunt of that. And God could stop that if he wanted to, but he doesn't. He's always there. He's always able to protect the innocent. But the pattern of God's action in the world is set for us in the very first actions after the fall. Because he accepts Cain's offering and he accepts Abel's offering, he doesn't accept Cain's. He makes clear that Abel is pleasing to him, Abel's sacrifice is pleasing to him, but Cain's is not. And after that, all the care is lavished on Cain. He comes to talk to Cain, he warns Cain, he gives Cain's prophecies about the future, he rebukes Cain when he goes wrong, he makes miraculous interventions for Cain. He doesn't do a bloomin' thing for Abel. He just stands by and lets Abel die. That's a pattern for providence in a post-fall world. And why is that? Well, the book of Job helps us approach that question in the right sort of way. You have to think in terms of each individual's relationship to God. Abel was in a good relationship with God, and there was no reason why he couldn't die then. He was safe, he was home. Cain was murderous. The one in trouble there is Cain. And so the divine attention is lavished on Cain, who does need a lot of help in turning and coming towards God. So that's what I think the book of Job can show us about those things.
For more information about the Veritas Forum, including additional recordings and a calendar of upcoming events, please visit our website at www.veritas.org.